We've taken in more trades, and our used inventory is bigger than ever. And McMahon's Import Corner has one of the state's best selections of late model Toyotas, Hondas, and Subarus. We've also added certified pre-owned Chevys and Buicks. And with the Cash for Junkers program, where you get a guaranteed minimum trade allowance of $3,000 towards any used vehicle in stock, we're rapidly becoming your used car superstore.
With the matching supplier pricing on every new vehicle in stock only at McMahon, and the Cash for Junkers deal on every used vehicle in stock, you've got to check us out. The new McMahon Chevy Buick on the corner of Route 15 and Route 100 in Morrisville.
Come see why McMahon Chevy Buick is growing so fast. The reason is simple. Because at the new McMahon Chevy Buick, we make deals the other guys won't. Chevy, find new roads.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Thank you, Jim Conde. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Hope you had a fabulous weekend. How could you miss yesterday, right? Thanks for spending part of your morning with us. Coming up on the program in just a moment or two here, we're going to be chatting with a political economist and historian. We're going to talk about the inequality in this country, pretty stark, and talk about what some of the solutions might be. I'm sure you'll have some thoughts and comments as well on the program about the announcement yesterday by Hillary Clinton that she's running for president. Now, that is a big surprise, isn't it? We'll chat with our White House crew about that to begin hour number two, and we'll take your phone calls throughout the program. You can reach us at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. Forecaster Roger Hill says we're going to get into the 70s today. You got to love that. All right. We go to the phone. We begin the week this morning. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Gal Alperovitz, who's the author of What Then Must We Do? Straight talk about the next American Revolution. As I mentioned, Gar is a political economist and a historian who also wrote a interesting book about the use of the atomic bomb by this country. And he's joining us this morning from Burlington. Gar, good morning. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
You describe this, as I mentioned, you talk a lot about the inequality in this country. And, you know, I think we've heard a lot of these numbers, but frankly, you laid them out in a way that is pretty stark. Let's talk a little bit about the 1%. How dominant is the 1% in this country?
Well, it depends what you're talking about, 1% of income or 1% of wealth. The top 1% of wealth, let me give you this figure that's even more sharp. The top 1% of wealth is more wealth than the bottom half easily, but the top 400 people, think about this one, 400 individuals alone have more wealth than the bottom 180 million Americans taken together. So that the income of the top 1% has gone from about 10% of the income over the last 30 years to roughly 22% over the last 30 years, which means that the bottom 80% is basically just been treading water at best.
And you say there's a corresponding drop that's happened for that group of people as the 1% has gone up.
Yes, and one study suggests that virtually all of the economic gains of the entire economic system, you know, give or take, have gone to the top 1% over that period. It's an extraordinary change.
Who are those 400 people?
Well, the 400 people that usually, these are from the Forbes study of the top 400 people. You know who they are. They are top executives. They are top investors. There are people like Warren Buffett, who is an investor. There are people like, if you look at yesterday's New York Times, a very interesting study. They are the presidents of Disney, for instance. Yesterday's study reported in the New York Times was done by a good friend of mine who's an economist, who showed that the number at the top is 2,000 times, this is the income number, the median wage within the company. And he's leading, just think about that, 2,000 mm-hmm. times more income than the median worker.
Mm-hmm.
That's an extraordinary. Now, obviously, there are many companies, they report on a number of the big ones yesterday. That's the latest study we've seen. But you don't have to go that far. And many studies have shown 350 to 400 times or 200 times is the bottom income. So we're way out of line with other countries around the world on these figures, by the way.
How did we get that way?
Well, I think it's a combination, particularly in this country, the rapid decline of unions, which at least held the line for a long time. Unions were, excuse me, about 34-35% of the labor force unionized just after the war. They're down to about 11% now. And indeed, in the private sector, it's just 6.5-7%. And they're going down further. And unions are important, not only holding the line on wages, but politically they help build a stronger Democratic Party, which at least counterbalance some parts of the Republican Party and the corporate part of that. You know, in other countries, unions at some point in Sweden, for instance, were 85% of the labor force at a certain point in history at the top. In Germany and Britain and France, they were in the 30 and 40% range, 50%. We are way, way, way on the bottom. And so there's what Kenneth Galbraith, the great late Kenneth Galbraith, who was a great economist, used to talk about countervailing power. That is, the power to balance the big corporations. Was basically union power throughout the economy and also politically. That's just disappeared. And now under very severe attack in Wisconsin and elsewhere to basically rid the country of any significant union power. And that means it's going to get worse, not better, in terms of inequality.
That's interesting that you say that the unions are a counterbalance within the Democratic Party to the corporate part of it. You know, I can't help but think of Hillary Clinton when you say that.
Well, it's, you know, the Democratic Party has two divisions. I'm here in Vermont, and there's a good progressive part of the party here. But yes, that's right. She has typically had very close ties to Wall Street.
Now, you at one point talk about movements in this country, and you talk about the civil rights movement, and you include a number of others, gay rights, and then you include the conservative movement. Talk to me about what you think is going on right now in the conservative movement.
Well, the point, just to underline the part of the question you asked, the way to think about this period is to think about not simply who gets elected tomorrow. That's obviously very important in the country. But thinking about how politics changes over time, including movements that don't look like they're going anywhere. So if you go way back to the beginning of the environmental movement, I happen to run Gaylord Nelson, the senator who started Earth Day. I was his legislative director during the 1960s. Environmental movement came really out of the conservation movement and did not have a chance at all, most people thought, in the 1960s of achieving any significant gains. And slowly, over time, it built up until it exploded. Now, it's under attack now, has to hold the line, but over 30 years, the buildup occurred. If you think about the women's movement, the same thing. It's a 30-40-year movement, also in terms of gender issues and gay rights. The questions of change over time are long, year-by-year, decade-by-decade movements that build power. And for the first period, you don't see much. You see as grassroots development. And that's the same thing important to know about the conservative movement. In the 1940s, the dominant conservative movement that you see today was a sidebar issue. They were marginalized in American politics. And they worked very hard to get where they now are in a dominant position. They had a lot of advantages as they built because there was a lot of corporate and other money supporting them. But in fact, conservatives were way, way out in the margins. And I think in one sense they're a lesson to progressives on the left to take heart. If you roll up your sleeves and think about decades rather than just the election, that's how it's done. Obviously, there are big splits in the conservative movement today, and that's one of the, for progressives, that's an opening because some very extreme positions are being taken in parts of the conservative movement, and as well as more moderate kind of positions, as well as the Wall Street kind of movement, part of the conservative movement. So they are divided as well as large and powerful, and there may be openings.
What's driven the strength of the conservative party?
One thing that's driven it is money. Yesterday's Washington Post, I just flew up from Washington yesterday, reported on the difference in fundraising by groups that are supporting kind of progressive and conservative elections this year. The Koch brothers announced just about 2 weeks ago an organization of very, very wealthy and very, very conservative donors building up a kind of a war chest for the coming election. Not only at the national level, but at the state and local level, because they're working hard at all three levels.
Yeah.
And the number that they announced was just under $900 million, almost $1 billion.
Wow.
And there's a meeting this week, the Washington Post reported, of a similar group of donors, very wealthy progressives. They hope maybe to get to $200 million. In other words, about a fifth the power financially. Now, those are obviously not exact figures, but they're symbolic of the level of funding that's available to the two sides.
Wow. That's just breathtaking, isn't it?
It is. I knew that the differences are great, but that's a very startling set of numbers. Yesterday's New York Times and Washington Post, for those who follow these, contained that number and the numbers on the ratio of top executives to the median worker. So two sets of numbers were released yesterday that tell you an awful lot about inequality and political power.
Talking with Gar Alperovitz, he's the author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. You can join us at 244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. You describe what's going on in this country economically as more of a systemic problem than a political problem. Can you distinguish between those two for me, please?
Yeah, and I think it's a very important issue. We've just launched something with a lot of political and economic and academic and activists and number of people who, the president of the American Political Science Association, the American Sociological Association, the Academy of Management president, and a whole series of folks, Bob Reich, the former Secretary of Labor. Large number of people, 350 people, signed a statement saying it's now time to understand and to talk about and begin to explore the fact that we do face a profound problem in the system itself, not just a political problem. And what that means is this. You can elect Democrats and you can elect Republicans. Over 30 years, the big trends, inequality, number of people in prison, which has gone up steadily over 30 years, percentage-wise, environment, climate change, civil liberties, a whole series of issues that have been defined, and you'll find in my book, What Then Must We Do, they've all gone south steadily for 30 years. Doesn't matter whether you elect Democrats or Republicans in terms of the big trends. Now, it certainly does matter on the margins. It's very important, and I'm obviously on the progressive side. But when the big trends keep going south, you know something deeper in the system is going on. And so that's the focus. And unless we talk about why is the power arranged as it is, why are corporations so powerful in the country, and why are these trends continuing, we don't get to the issues. We elect people, but the trends get worse. And what surprised me is the response to this. I mean, lots of people talk about this, but we just opened this Next System Project initiative. The enormous response we've had to people saying, yes, it's time to have that conversation. We've been talking around the margins, and nobody's been facing it except small groups here and there. It's time for a wide-ranging public discussion of what this is all about. And, you know, what we've also found is people say, you know, we think there are very, very severe problems with American and other corporate capitalism, but we also think that there's very, very obvious problems with state socialism. And can't we do better?
Mm-hmm.
We've got a whole new century. Can't we begin to explore? You know, Vermont is a place where you're exploring all sorts of local and important state initiatives and alternatives. And that's happening all over the country, the kind of nitty-gritty that builds up over time to local models and ultimately building on what we learn at the local level to state models and regional models that are different and more sustainable and more equitable. That kind of debate is what we need, a long-term debate about how we change the system really from the bottom up.
You're actually quite optimistic in this book. I was sort of I was a little surprised because, you know, the numbers that you lay out can be pretty discouraging. But you actually talk in a pretty positive way. There's a section you have, the prehistory of the next American Revolution, where, I mean, the takeaway that I had from that is that you're not feeling as though the system is so overwhelmed that nothing different can happen. I mean, you talk about this idea of one bolt, starting with one bolt. I love that. So can you talk about that a little bit?
One bolt is, my father was an engineer, mm-hmm. and he told this wonderful story, and it's about system change. He said his very first year as a freshman at the University of Wisconsin in engineering class, a tough old German professor, you know, obviously it's in the days before PowerPoint, unrolled a huge picture of a, you know, multi-engine, multi-wheeled locomotive in front of the class, gigantic, in front of the whole room. And all these freshman engineers, including my father, were there. He said, we're going to redesign this entire system. We're going to start with one bolt tomorrow. I think that there's something in that. That is, you start in Vermont or many parts of the country now with one cooperative, for instance. The worker cooperatives are popping up all over the country now. And I would say that's one bolt. It kind of shows that people can own and control and manage development themselves in a different way. There are many bolts we can talk about. For instance, in Boulder, Colorado, they've just taken public, took over a municipal enterprise, made it into a municipally owned enterprise. It's on the verge of becoming that in order to deal with climate change. That's another bolt. Land Trust, which you've had here in Burlington for a long time, which takes kind of a way of managing and owning the land and housing prices so that they're controlled rather than by developers. It's another bolt. The farming in this state particularly, there are green developments all over the country. Then that's another bolt. So what you see, if you look at the trends at the top level, you see the decay. If you look at the bottom level, you see the response to the problem. And I'm a historian, and I pay very careful attention to things that develop slowly at the bottom. That's where the real developmental process occurs, and you only see the eruptions as it builds up over time. So viewing the long, you know, 10, 20, 30 years of, as I said earlier, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, including the conservative movement, and then the environmental movement, there's a long, long buildup. So I'm not a utopian optimist and things and certainty that everything is going to get better. But I'm also very skeptical of people who look at today's very, very, very difficult reality and think that's the truth. They often miss what's coming next. Let me give you one further example from my own experience. As I mentioned, I'm from Wisconsin originally. And in Wisconsin, most people don't remember Joseph McCarthy, the really very, very, very reactionary and prosecuting kind of senator who called everybody a communist from the moderate Republicans on down and scared the country really into quiet for many, many years in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And in Wisconsin, it was worse because he was from Wisconsin, so there was great fear. Now, if you asked anybody in the 1950s, in that environment, could anything possibly change? Now, the answer was obviously nothing could change because it was really very, very difficult to say anything. Even in the moderates of the Republican Party were shaking in their boots.
Yeah.
And so what happened next? The 1960s exploded, totally unpredicted.
Yeah.
So I'm skeptical of people who say, well, you know, the power is so great that we can't do anything. And what that really often is an excuse for not rolling up their sleeves and getting out and doing something useful.
Well, I mean, as you point out, no one predicted the fall of the Berlin Wall a couple of years before it happened. No one thought apartheid was going to end. Nobody guessed what happened in Tunisia. So, you know, I mean, you're right. I mean, really, truly, I mean, one of the wonderful things about, you know, the world is that really, in a way, anything can happen.
You know, that's the lesson, and that the book, What Then Must We Do, which is, you know, published by Chelsea Green here in Burlington, which great publisher, by the way, and a worker-owned company, as you mentioned.
Yep.
Again, another sign of that. That's the message, that there is, beneath the surface, a lot going on. I should, you know, another thing just to note, in most parts of the country, the local newspapers don't cover what's going on locally in these things. Mostly it's because newspapers are under such severe financial constraints these days with the Internet taking over in a way. They don't have the money to pay for local reporters and reporting. And in some cases, you know, there's a very, very conservative ownership of many parts of the local newspapers. So people don't realize that there's a huge amount going on under the surface that it goes unreported. I should mention a website that we manage that tries to capture some of this. It's simply called www.community community-wealth.org. Put the dash in because there's one without, community-wealth. And that simply reports on a lot of the things I'm mentioning so quickly in passing.
Let's go to Bethel. Davis, good morning. How are you today?
Good morning, Mark, and good morning to your guests. The McCarthy thing was interesting because my father was a target of the McCarthy era and stuff, but that's another point. I guess my question is, if Bernie is going to run, which he is thinking of doing, and he's going to run on a platform of ideas with not necessarily thinking to win but to promulgate these ideas, what bolts would your guests suggest that Bernie tighten down in order to spread the message, which we all know very well here in Vermont about the 1% and all that, but how would your guests suggest that Bernie get these ideas out? Should he change anything that he's doing or what? I just like his comments on that point.
Or are we all just screws, right?
Well, Bernie, you know, Bernie's a great guy on virtually all these issues, and I'm glad he's really thinking of making that challenge. You know, what he has introduced legislation to do, what you have, one of the two state agencies that attempt to support worker-owned companies. There are two in the country, and yours is one of the best. Ohio has put some funding into it as well. That is a step that should go to the national level. We should have a major federal bank and or technical assistance organization that promotes the development, as we do with small business, that promotes co-ops and worker-owned companies, and that the model that you've pioneered here and that Bernie has supported national legislation for is one plank. A second one is, I know you made a strong effort to do both single-payer and also state banking, and what you've devised is a way here in the state of Vermont at least to use some state funds to have a quasi-public banking system. It really isn't a banking system, but it acts in that way using state funds. Many states are beginning to do that. That's a model for a public national bank that could follow either infrastructure development or green development or environmental development, and that's another piece of the puzzle. By the way, as I assume most folks know, that the state of North Dakota has a publicly owned bank and has had it for 100 years.
Right.
Very profitable, very much supported by the business and farming groups, by co-ops around the state. If you like, you know, North Dakota is one of our more conservative northern states, but it actually has a genuinely socialist bank, if you like. And in fact, there it is, very practical operation. But using public funds, I was talking to someone very high up in the Treasury Department just this weekend, and that the notion that the United States government doesn't have an infrastructure bank to finance long-term investment is really ridiculous in world development. So that's another piece of the puzzle. I would go to those three areas first, and then I would, you know, begin moving beyond in terms of, these are all things that I'm sure Bernie is more aware of than most of us and is already doing. Radical reduction in the military budget, and he's on that one as well, and pulling back on some of these excursions abroad. I could go on, but I think you get the direction, and he probably doesn't need much coaching from me. I think he's doing great.
Can he actually make a difference, or is he just going to get steamrolled by the Clinton machine?
Oh, he can make, again, let's go back to how historical change occurs. Bernie's not running in order to get elected president of the United States at this point. He's a realist. What we need to do is open the debate. And this is early. If you want to play this game, serious political change, throw three decades on the table. How do you develop the ideas? How do young people begin to learn a new direction? How do we slowly develop in the state of Vermont and the state of Maryland, where we've been working, in Colorado, where the Boulder, Colorado experiment is going on in many parts of the country, and we've seen this in many cities, Jacksonville, Florida, and Richmond, Virginia, and Richmond, California, and Atlanta. There's really interesting experiments all over. How do those ideas begin to coalesce over time? If you think, you know, what can we do now to hold the line and do the best we can, that's one thing, and it has to be done. The other is to build up new ideas and new people and young people and new experiments that show the way of the future. Again, if you look at the way the New Deal developed in the so-called state and local laboratories of democracy, almost all the national New Deal programs, they came out of the things that had been done at the state and local level. Mm. And then when the time was right and they developed, they became politically important. So talking about it, openly discussing these problems as a systemic problem, beginning to think long term, doing the local experiments, doing what Bernie's doing to change the climate, raising these issues. All of that is what you've picked up that term. That's the prehistory that makes, that's where the real differences are made. I sometimes think, and you know, this is just a personal way of looking at it. My heroes in the civil rights movement, my heroes really are the people in the 1930s and 1940s in Mississippi, really 30 years before what we call the modern civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s. Those were people who, if you had asked them, what are you doing trying to do civil rights in Mississippi, they're going to hang you, and they often did after torturing you. Those are the people who laid the groundwork step by step and inspired people and gave new ideas and built up for the longer term. And I'm not a utopian. As I say, I'm a historian. That is a very conventional process, very demanding and very, very inspiring, but of people getting awareness and developing ideas, that's where the action is today, and the people are doing local experiments, local farm experiments, local food, local electric, local energy. That work now, and worker co-ops, and all the things I've begun to mention, and what then must we do, the book covers a lot of this. That's where the groundwork gets laid. That, and in the realm of ideas of, you know, Bernie running to open up space for new ideas, the next system project, which we've been involved with, opening up space for new ideas. That's laying the groundwork. You can't harvest if you don't plant, and the plant and dig and put things in the soil early on. And so I think that's where we are now. And there are a lot of people around the country doing that, just below the radar.
Gar Alperovitz is the author of What Then Must We Do? 244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. Let me just be cynical for a moment, though. When you talk about this, whether it's the environment or the economy, I mean, let me just use that last analogy you gave there. So you plant all these seeds, but if you've got the Koch brothers with $900 million, that's like a hurricane coming through. What's the point?
Well, the answer is history is unknown. We don't know who's going to win that battle. That's number one. There are a lot more people. Koch brothers are in the top 0.1% or even higher, right? There are a lot more people in the 99% on the other side of that issue who have a lot to gain by beginning to get serious about what the country ought to look like. So that's second point. Radical change or far-reaching change is as common, really, as grass in world history, if you look beyond it. And it's always the 1% or the tiny percent that's on top. We always know that. But look at what happened in the Soviet Union. It collapsed. Apartheid collapsed. Rome disappeared. That's what the top rulers were. And country by country, you see this process. Now, it doesn't always work that way. You sometimes see very long-standing, very powerful groups dominant for very long periods of time. But if you look through Latin America today, the dictators who manage many of those countries are gone, and against heavy odds. Again, 10, 20-year processes changing what happened in Latin America. I sometimes tease people because, particularly in New England, part of the country where I spent a good deal of time several years ago, a bunch of farmers and local merchants, they were, you know, tiny merchants and farmers beat the British Empire in the Great American Revolution. So if you'd ask those folks, can you take on the British Empire at that time, they would, you know, most people would laugh at you, and if they didn't kind of run out of the room and say, I don't want to get involved in anything like that. So I'm partly teasing, but partly as a historian, I'm skeptical. And I think people ought to be skeptical that what you see today, even when it's very powerful, is what you get. That's often a good excuse for doing nothing.
Right.
And, you know, so I'm very, very skeptical of it as a historian, and I'm, you know, kind of challenging it just as a fellow citizen that may be an excuse for really not getting out there and trying to do something. And you find lots more people, I think, are beginning around the country. That's what's exciting. There's a kind of a new economy movement where lots of people, younger people and older people, are beginning to get serious about trying to do something, and rather than saying, well, nothing can be done.
An email question from Jim in Huntington who asks, as someone born and raised in a progressive family in Milwaukee, the thing I see missing from today's progressive agenda in Vermont is the expectation of accountability to oneself, family, education, community, and country. When will current progressives let go of the any behavior goes, lack of accountability, it's not your fault mantra that is driving so many traditionalists to the conservative side of the aisle?
You know, I think I know what the person who wrote the email has in mind, but I see lots of people who are taking real personal responsibility, responsibility for the environment, responsibility for political activity, responsibility for self-help economic activity. That is, these worker co-ops are certainly roll-up-your-sleeves kind of activity. I know what he's talking about, but I'm also very skeptical when you actually look at what people are doing who are beginning to do things in a real way.
How do you dismantle the economic system at the top? I mean, this Koch brothers, the money in the political system. I mean, I think really when you come right down to it, that's the real rot in the system. So how do you deal with this money question?
You know, I think if you start at the top, I think you're really making a big mistake. I used to run staff in both the House and Senate in the 1960s. At that point, there was enough power to start at the top and do serious regulation of the environment, for instance.
Okay.
That has changed radically, largely in very significant part because the decline of labor unions. Labor unions, by the way, were part of the coalition that elected progressive Democrats who were interested in the environment. We often think of labor and environment fighting with each other.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the leading environmentalists was the senator whose staff I directed, Gaylord Nelson. Gaylord was a labor union lawyer, but he was also an environmentalist, and you needed both pieces to get those folks elected, and that's where the real power came. Now, unfortunately, labor has declined. So starting at the top is not the place to start. The place to start is where you live and what state you're in, and take the long view of how we build up and challenge in this particular state. And Vermont is obviously a good example, but Wisconsin, my home state, is a very, very difficult state, but it's not without hope. Walker has won two elections, and I think they made a mistake on the second recall attempt, and most people now think that was an error. Because why? Because people in Wisconsin, good citizens of Wisconsin, thought, well, he got elected fair and square. This recall business is not fair and square until he has more of a record, and I think it was a mistake to challenge him.
Mm-hmm.
But simultaneously, in Wisconsin, they elected a very, very interesting, the first gay woman senator in the United States simultaneously, so that you have a state where people are open to what's the best answer, what's a good answer, and sometimes get thrown in one direction or another. Starting at the bottom is the key, and that means local politics, but also local projects, building up these nuts and bolts and environment to worker companies and municipal-owned enterprise, state banks, state single-payer, which I think is going to happen in several states over time. 20 states have introduced legislation for it. Slowly building up all that groundwork. You don't launch a national campaign in a serious way unless you've done an awful lot of spade work. And that's the exciting part of what's going on. Hold the line as best you can nationally, but also pay attention to, where you live and home base. I think that's the way of the future. The interesting thing about, starting locally and doing these positive things is, in one sense, you can't lose because it's all positive no matter what. But even if you can't move the trends, which I think we can, there's very little to lose by the kinds of things that are going on in many states, and Vermont being one of the leaders, of course.
Last question. So how do you strengthen labor movement? How do you strengthen the labor movement? And I guess two-part question here. How do you get people to participate and vote and participate in the political process?
Well, the labor movement question is a difficult one. I think that the labor movement, as we know it, is a movement in radical decline. Partly because, it was an industrial labor movement, and they've been able to move a great deal of the industries that once were there abroad. Partly because the movement itself needs internal reform in many cases, and partly because it's been under severe attack. But this is happening all over the world. The labor movement, as we know it, has declined. I think the future is going to be new institutional development that is, gets us kind of beyond these forms. As I say, it kind of looks for neighborhood ownership, worker co-ops, land trusts, state banks. I'm moving up the level, municipal ownership, state banks. The most interesting kind of one development at a larger level is the Tennessee Valley Authority, which is a interesting, you might even call it a socialist institution, huge, gigantic utility that does management of the river system as well. And it's the largest socialist institution in the United States. The Obama administration tried to get rid of it, and all the Republicans in that area of the Tennessee and the whole valley, of course, all the Republican senators opposed him because they wanted to keep it. So we may even see movement to the regional level and national level of public banks, and which are very common in many parts of the country, many parts of the world, progressively over time. That's how I would see the development.
Wow, that's fascinating. You know, with the Tennessee Valley Authority starting with FDR now being defended by the Republicans.
Yeah, it's a very interesting development.
You know, I noticed in these stories about Hillary Clinton this morning that they talk about how she'll get a challenge and there's going to be people from the left. I have yet to see a story that mentions Bernie Sanders' name. They all keep talking about this fantasy of Elizabeth Warren running. What do you make of that?
Well, she has really captured the imagination of lots of folks. And so long as she is still in the picture and Bernie hasn't yet really announced, hasn't become a Democrat, which he has to do.
Right, right. Maybe that's it.
To enter the race seriously in the Democratic Party, he's got to do that. And I suppose that's really going to be, that's a tough decision, but I think he probably's going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And when he does that, then it'll get much more interesting, I think.
Are you talking somewhere locally soon?
Yes, I'm speaking later today at the University of Vermont. That's really why I'm here.
Okay, what time is that, Gar?
Let me pick up the schedule and get you the exact data.
I'm talking with Gar Alperovitz. He's the author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution.
It's 4 o'clock at the Livak, LIVAK Ballroom at Davis Center at the University of Vermont.
You can get at least 4,000 or 5,000 in that ballroom, so we'll expect a big crowd.
Okay, all's welcome.
Thank you for your time this morning. I appreciate it very much.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Gar Alperovitz, the author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. The subhead here, democratizing wealth and building a community-sustaining economy from the ground up. All right, here's my question for you after hearing him. Optimistic, pessimistic, cynical, what do you think? I thought he's got a pretty positive takeaway in what sometimes seems a situation that's completely overwhelming. You know, whether it's the economy or what we're doing to the planet, all that sort of thing. So I'd be curious to know what your take is after you heard our discussion with him. Also, you know, on this point here, we can talk a little bit about where are you at in this dispute between the administration and the state employees union rally over the weekend. Some pretty harsh words coming from the governor on our program on Friday. Things really seem to be quite ahead here, so we can chat about where are you at on this? I'd be curious to know. Your thoughts, comments, welcome on the program. You can join us at 244-1777. That's our local number in Central Vermont. And toll-free, you can reach us at 877-291-8255. We'll be back right after this.
Ruben and his team.